Hey there, everybody. Welcome to Jazz United. This is Greg Bryant, host of Jazz After Hours on WBGO.
And I'm Nate Chenin, editorial director at WBGO.
We want to tell you Happy New Year. First of all, if this is your first time, welcome to Jazz United. We like to talk about generally just what's on our minds and different issues and happenings in our music community. And today, it's all about Pixar's Soul.
That's right. This is a movie that we both watched a couple of times over the holidays. It premiered on Disney Plus on Christmas Day, co-directed by Pete Docter and Kemp Powers. This is the first Pixar film to feature an African-American character as its central figure. And, of course, it is the first movie in the Pixar universe that puts jazz at the center of the frame.
That's right. That's right. This film is about one day, basically, in the life of the protagonist by the name of Joe Gardner. He's been earning a living as a middle school band teacher, but he stumbles into what's going to be the gig of his life with the Dorothea Williams Quartet. But he suffers a freak accident and finds himself in a spiritual limbo that they call the Great Before. Jamie Foxx voices the character of Joe Gardner, and the musical parts are played by John Batiste, who wrote and performed the jazz portions of the score with a really hip hand-picked band.
And that's just about all we can say here before issuing a spoiler warning. So go no further if you intend to see this movie, but you have not gotten around to it yet. Watch the film, bookmark us here, come back when you're ready, because we're going to talk about what Soul gets right about jazz and the Black experience and where it came up short.
Mm-hmm. Or if you're like me, you know, and you don't mind, listen on and see how they act out the movie, because we're going to go in on it.
You're immune to spoilers, apparently.
That's right.
There are some twists in this film, and I think, you know, we'll talk about that. But first of all, you know, this is the Jazz United podcast, and this is a really prominent example of jazz in the movies, really kind of maybe the most prominent we've seen in a while. But it joins some other big Hollywood productions, like, you know, the recent works of Damien Chazelle, who made Whiplash and La La Land. And, you know, to some extent, you could say Green Book is a jazz movie, the Farrelly Brothers movie starring Mahershala Ali as pianist Don Shirley. But, you know, those films use jazz as a backdrop, right?
Yeah.
And in this one, it really is sort of the central engine of the plot.
It is, Nate. When you first proposed the idea that we talked about this movie, Soul, I started to push back at first. I'm really not the cat that has enjoyed jazz on the silver screen. We've had some brilliant documentaries, but feature films have always somehow for me come up short. You know, I think about Bird, you know, with Eastwood, and even the Miles Davis feature film from a few years back. I just cannot bring myself to watch anymore. They just get it so wrong most of the time. But, you know, we've got to give it to the folks at Pixar. They really did their sourcing. They really did their research. I know you watched the end credits several times, several names I know I recognize. I know you did too.
Yeah. Well, the musicians in the film who do the ghosting are all people that we follow actively. John Batiste put together this band. He's got Marcus Gilmore on drums. He's got Linda Mahon Oh on bass. There's a really prominent role given to a saxophonist whose parts are played both by Tia Fuller and Eddie Barbash. And yeah, in addition to the musical performers, there were consultants on this movie. You know, people like Terry Lynn Carrington and Herbie Hancock. I'm also thinking about Aaron Deal. You know, there were a handful of people who came in and just kind of tried to make sure that they got the details right.
Exactly.
In addition to, I think, what they call the Pixar Cultural Trust, which was, you know, it's funny, but similar to what they had to do when they made the Disney film Moana about Pacific Islanders, bringing in people who could just check them and make sure that they were actually getting the details right, in this case about the Black American experience, mm-hmm. which is something that Pixar has never really dealt with.
Right.
So there's a lot to unpack here. And I guess before we go any further, I just wanted to ask you whether you agree that in terms of texture mm-hmm. and atmosphere, this movie does some pretty remarkable work.
They do, Nate. First, going back to John Batiste, his technical prowess on the piano was used for Joe Gardner, the character's finger movements. So you mm-hmm. see very accurate depiction, not just of, you know, how to play chords, but oftentimes, you know, when you see him hit a C on the piano, it's a C, you know, it's an A, you know, that's a super attention to detail, as Pixar is noted for.
It's amazing how little effort went into that historically, you know, yeah. So it's like put a trumpet in, you know, Kirk Douglas's hands and just hope for the best, you know, but there's also the feeling of these spaces too. Mm-hmm. And I should say, it's not just the jazz stuff, but I don't think I've ever seen New York City rendered as lovingly as it is in the outdoor scenes and in the subway scenes and, right. you know, just the street energy on the level of animation. Mm-hmm. It's really, really remarkable. But there's a club that plays a really crucial role in this film called the Half Note.
Right.
And the exterior of the club looks a little bit like the Blue Note and it looks a little bit like the Vanguard. But then when you go inside and get the view of the stage, it is basically a pitch perfect recreation of the Village Vanguard,
right?
You know, down to the pictures on the walls and that red velvet curtain. And when I saw that for the first time in this movie, I had a sharp intake of breath, you know, 'cause it's like, oh my God,
yeah.
It's really transporting, you know?
Indeed.
And so I thought that was really cool.
I'll say also, as far as attention to detail, I was actually rather impressed with the Dorothea Williams character. I feel like the vibe of the stern jazz elder was recreated and maximized, and the acceptance of the protagonist, Joe Gardner. You know, she didn't say, "Hey, man, you know, we're glad to have you. You play great."
Right.
So it was like, right. "Hey, man, where have you been? Do you have a suit? This is the time you show up." And that's the approval, man. Not all of these, you know, platitudes and carrying on.
Joe Gardner, where have you been?
I've been teaching middle school band, but on the weekends,
You got a suit?
I...
Get a suit, Teach. A good suit. Back here tonight, first show's at 9, sound check's at 7. We'll see how you do.
Yeah, so this is the saxophonist who is really presented throughout the film as one of the greats, right? Like a living legend of sorts. And so playing as a sideman on her gig mm-hmm. is what's presented as the big break that Joe Gardner's supposed to have,
right.
Like his opportunity of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And I agree that the way that she sort of skeptically receives him at first,
mm-hmm.
you know, like she's not all that happy to see him
right.
When he shows up. And then he plays a solo on this, you know, this tune that John Batiste wrote for Dorothea Williams's band.
Mm-hmm.
And in this solo, he kind of goes off on this fantasia of a solo. He just gets lost in it. You know, the suspense is when he sort of snaps out of it, has he gotten himself into trouble or has he actually won their approval?
Right.
And it's the latter. But, you know, it's funny. It raises for me one question I had for you. There's an idea in this movie that inspiration is very much a solitary endeavor. And that was one of the things that I wish could have been fleshed out better. You know, mm-hmm. this idea that really, when you're in the zone as a jazz musician, as a member of a band, that's not something that happens, you know, just in yourself, you know, like that's not you going off somewhere. You've still got to be connected. And,
right.
and so that to me rang a bit of a false note.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you there. And the whole idea of being there is somehow an unhealthy obsession. No, I think in the zone is more of getting out of your own way. And as you've just stated, being a part of the communal experience to where we're not thinking about what we're doing. We're thinking about nothing at all. We're just existing in this safe space of creativity that is community.
Let's talk about his trajectory as a musician. Am I alone in thinking that this movie is a little bit insulting to music educators?
Indeed.
if you can't teach, is that the message here?
Oh man, don't address your letters to me, folks. No kidding. But honestly, you make a good point here. It's like, okay, well, why isn't that a dream gig for someone? Why isn't that someone's burning passion or a drive or spark, as they say in the movie? Why can't that be someone's spark? Yeah, I really didn't dig that. And my main thing, Nate, and I don't want to get too far ahead of things, but I don't understand why jazz and the paradigm of winning the gig, keeping your chops strong, trying to get to that next plateau in the music, why couldn't that have been the story alone? There's already this escape to the great before or these nether regions. Honestly, I think jazz is so complicated and complex enough where we could have just stayed in the protagonist struggle to really make it as a legit on the scene musician. And that could have had all of the trimmings. I really don't know why it had to be 50% in this after roll thing. That really made me upset, to be honest.
Yeah. So I'm going to pull back the camera focus a little bit here, because this fits into a larger conversation about jazz on film. We've seen, really since the beginning of Hollywood, this trope of the doomed musician who has to choose between a kind of respectable, conservative life, this life that conforms to societal norms, or playing what amounts to the devil's music.
Yeah.
You know? Like, am I going to pursue my muse and my dream and possibly ruin everything else? This sort of Faustian bargain that's often portrayed. And it's interesting to think about soul in that context, because while I appreciate that Joe Gardner is not a junkie, he doesn't have any demons per se, but the drive that he has, the ambition he has to prove himself, which is sort of tangential to, but still connected to, his hunger for transcendence, for musical transcendence, right? So, you know, on the one hand, he wants to find that zone. He wants to get himself in the zone and find that plane where he's almost floating above his body, right? I think any musician, certainly improviser, can relate to that. But then on the other hand, he wants to see his name in lights too.
Yeah.
So that is sort of held up as antithetical to the idea of being a complete human, you know, and being able to live in the world. And so in some sneaky way, I feel like this movie actually perpetuates this idea that jazz is not is, but can be a destructive force.
Yeah, I hear that.
Is that a stretch? I mean,
it's not. No, it's not at all. And the whole idea of where is the counterbalance of it's okay to pursue your dreams, whether you reach them or not. If that is, again, your spark, it should not be demonized. I think in general, this whole thing of people selling out to jazz and only doing one thing and being monolithic in their pursuits has been just a tired, recurring plot that we've seen, and they had a chance to make it right, and I don't think they did. Again, there's a lot weighing on this movie, the first African-American protagonist in a Pixar film, and we only see him in his African-American body, if you will, 50% of the time.
And there's a good stretch where you see that body, but the voice that comes out is the voice of a middle-aged white woman.
Right. Yeah.
Tina Fey inhabiting his body while he is relegated to the form of a cat.
You know, there's just not that much precedent here. You get an actual, you know, human being, main character, and yeah, it's just totally not what I was expecting. Again, a chance to really make things right was lost. And unfortunately, because we don't have a track record of a frequency of diversity in these movies,
mm-hmm.
there was a lot riding on this. And I just have to say, for me, it comes up short.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I've often thought that what we need is a jazz film that really somehow taps into the lived experience, which I think is what you're talking about, right? It's not melodrama. You know, all of the things that a musician has to go through and, you know, the balance between, you know, commerce and art and all of this, right? But what is the central dramatic crux when mm-hmm. you make a film like that? How do you not make it about that kind of, you know, choose the music or choose life? And in this case, the answer to that question was to take the greatest, most ageless philosophical question facing humankind, which is, what is the meaning of existence?
Mm-hmm.
And that is the dramatic crux. You know, I mean, it's not where I would have gone, but, you know, to be fair, that was where they started.
Right.
And then they brought jazz into it.
Right. You know, that's
what Pete Docter was interested in to begin with, was this larger question. We should maybe talk about the fact that this is a Pixar film. You could even say it's part of a trilogy of films, you know, the mm-hmm. others being Inside Out, another Pete Docter movie, and Coco,
right,
which deals with the afterlife. And I think both of those films are more successful than this one just as a film. And for me, Inside Out is the really close parallel, because once again, they've set up this whole system with its own set of rules and its own center of gravity. And like, this is the world that we have to accept. This is the machinery of this world is what makes this movie work. But in the case of Inside Out, I thought it was a really deft imagination of how human cognition and emotional intelligence work. And especially because you were dealing with a child's psyche, there was a little bit more flexibility there. There was a bit more fun there. And whereas with this one, I feel like we kept having to pause for these lengthy explanations of like, okay, well, here's the youth seminar and this, you know, well, these are the lost souls. And this is the, you know, I just felt like, mm-hmm. you know, I've seen other people make this joke, but it almost felt like a Christopher Nolan movie trapped inside this Pixar film.
That's good.
I mean, complexity on top of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And It was a little maddening.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Even with Coco, I think it was more streamlined, you know, mm-hmm. and having, again, the virtuosic guitar playing being like the central focus of this kid's life, you know, it's even more successful, in my opinion, than Soul. You know, again, not to beat a dead horse, but there just wasn't enough about the music for me. And I'm not talking about, you know, theory or running down names or albums or anything like that. But mm-hmm. just the complexity of, you know, how hard it is to ascend to being a working musician on this scene, you know, the whole inner politics, the unwritten rules of the bandstand and camaraderie and developing trust, you know, with mm-hmm. fellow musicians, you know, those are life lessons. And again, I'm lobbying for the Dorothea Williams Pixar movie, because I think they could really tell that story.
Yeah.
With that character. And if you want to go in with me on Nate and we rewrite the play and turn it into him, I'll split it with you.
Oh man, this is tempting. I'm with you on that. I think that she's underexplored here. You know, mm-hmm. it's a tantalizing character for sure. You know, why don't we hear, you know, we've been talking about sort of the metaphysics of it all. We haven't talked that much about the music itself just mm-hmm. yet. So maybe we should hear a bit of John Batiste's music for this film. He does a really nice job of creating themes that are sort of immediately graspable. I think the term he used was user-friendly jazz, which
okay.
is quite funny. You can tell that he knows the kinds of terminology he has to use when he goes out to Cupertino or goes out to Pixar campus.
Yeah.
But this tune appears in the film, and it's a beautiful dynamic. And the title gives you some sense of what he's thinking about. It's called Looking at Life.
Thank you.
That was Looking at Life, John Batiste at the piano and composition there, writing for the movie Soul that we're talking about today on Jazz United. And while we have your attention, I want to let you know, folks, that this is a listener-supported effort, Jazz United. We love doing this. This is fun for us, but it comes from a special place, as you know, WBGO, 88.3 FM Newark, WBGO.org on the web. If you have not had an opportunity to contribute to WBGO during our winter fund drive, we urge you to make your donation now. Help keep shows like this in the pipeline and coming straight to you as often as we can do them. Again, WBGO.org/support. That's where you can give online. WBGO.org/support. You can make your tax-deductible contribution to WBGO. And we thank you.
So, Greg, we've been talking about this Pixar film, and ostensibly, Pixar makes films for kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they kind of are for kids, and they kind of aren't.
Right.
And I would argue that when you have a movie that deals with deep existential questions, maybe it's not as much for kids as it should be.
Oh, man. You know what? Let's get some experts in here to talk about this.
Oh, some expert testimony. I actually have some people in the house here who might be able to help us with that. It so happens that my daughters are big Pixar fans, and they saw this movie with me. So why don't I toss it to them? This is Athena, age 10.
Hi.
And Rosalie, age 7.
Hi.
This is great. So good to see you guys again and have you guys on the show. Rosalie, you first. Tell me, did you enjoy the movie Soul?
Well, it wasn't really like a kid's movie, but I enjoyed the kiddie parts.
Okay. And Athena, how about you? What are your feelings about Soul, the movie?
Well, I think the same. Like, it was supposed to be a kid's movie, so there were some moments when a kid would enjoy it, and I enjoyed those moments.
I liked when 22 was looking inside Joe's brain, and she was like, jazz, jazz, more jazz. Ooh, who's Lisa?
That part was really funny. I like that.
Wait, how do you know all that?
It's all in this stupid brain of yours.
Hey, stay out of there.
Oh, relax. There's not much here. Jazz, jazz, more jazz. Oh, and someone named Lisa. Who's that?
Never mind.
Okay. I want to know something, though. How could this movie been more of a movie for kids?
Well, one of the biggest points of conversation about Soul in our house is how when the main character is a tunnel vision, middle-aged man, then it's not a kid's movie.
Okay.
Even if it's a cartoon, that doesn't make it a kid movie.
There are also a couple creepy parts in the movie. The Lost Soul parts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the obsession thing, like they could have conveyed like the thing about how like when you're obsessed it becomes like non-enjoyable and stuff.
They could have made it like less creepy.
It was really creepy.
Maybe just because they're like grown-ups, they don't like know that, like
it's scary for kids.
It's scary for kids.
Like there's really like pretty much nothing in that movie for a 7-year-old, and like even a 10-year-old, I got scared by that. I got like chills in a bad way because of that.
Wow. Well, I want to know, did you guys enjoy seeing young ladies actually playing instruments? Was that a cool thing in this movie?
It was definitely like nice seeing women doing something.
I think we both appreciated that a lot, like subconsciously and consciously, because I actually play trombone and I love singing like very, very, very much.
Wow.
And so I subconsciously appreciated that now that you're saying that. Like, I definitely liked that, especially because Connie, she played trombone, and I play trombone, so.
Man, that's really cool. That's really cool. You guys really watched this movie in detail, and I love it that you watched it as a family, and it's awesome to have you guys on Jazz United today. Thanks for stopping by, ladies.
This was awesome again!
Yay! Thanks for doing it.
We will go have sugar cookies now.
Sugar cookies.
Fun. That was fun. That was fun. Nate, thanks for making Rosalie and Athena available. I feel like I have allies in, in how this movie went, but they brought some things to the fore that was really cool. Thanks for letting them stop by, man.
Oh, yeah. My pleasure. You know, they are never shy about sharing their opinions. So All I did this time was put them in front of the microphone.
I love it.
We haven't really acknowledged this explicitly yet, but I get the sense that the jazz community at large, to the extent that you can generalize, is just so happy that the usual distortions are not at play. You know, it's kind of like, we'll cut them a break. We'll give them, you know, a lot of leeway, because ultimately they approach this with a core foundation of respect. Right? I think that's fair to say.
Yes. Yes, they did.
You know, so jazz people are so hungry for acknowledgement in this, you know, larger cultural sphere that will forgive a lot of those irksome things just because you came with that proper respect.
Exactly. You know, we can't really underestimate, you know, the sourcing and all of the creative consultants that the Pixar folks dug up to really involve with this movie. It really did make a difference. I'll give it to them on that.
So we should note that there are effectively two soundtracks to Soul, one of which is John Batiste's, you know, featuring these musicians we mentioned. And the other soundtrack is by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, depicting, you know, the more ethereal segments of the film, the great before, and, you know, those scenes where he's kind of floating in the ether, where he's, you know, headed toward, I don't know, soul extinction. And so there is this more sort of brooding, electronic, kind of ambient stuff, which I think is actually quite beautiful as well, and serves its purpose. I get the sense that Batiste and Reznor and Ross did collaborate. They did work together. But, you know, you definitely get the sense of, like, now we're doing this and now we're doing this.
Right.
They don't feel like they're the same thing, really.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit of a head trip. And so, oh, now we're back to jazz again, that type of effect. I did enjoy hearing, again, in the club scene with the Williams Quintet, Cristo Redentor came up. The Donald Byrd tune, or the Duke Pearson tune that Donald Byrd covered. Also, there was a point at which Joe Gardner answered the phone, and his ringtone was Mingus.
It was Haitian fight song, right?
That was really cool. Yeah.
That's one of those character details, you know.
It's exactly.
He is that kind of guy.
Yeah,
like he's the guy who would have a custom ringtone playing some Charles Mingus music for sure. Maybe Monk would have been more on the nose for him.
Oh, I would have loved that. I would have loved that.
You know, I wanted to bring up, sort of as a compare and contrast, this was not the only jazz-related film that I watched over the holiday break. The other one was on Netflix. The adaptation of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, the August Wilson play. And this, of course, stars Viola Davis as Ma Rainey. And it stars Chadwick Boseman in what I think is his final role. Is that right?
That's correct.
Once again, it's a day in the life, right? So all of the action takes place in this one crucial period of time. And just as we see how Joe Gardner interacts with Dorothea Williams's, you know, bandmates and comports himself on the bandstand, we get to see how Ma Rainey's backup band rehearses their material, you know, before a recording session. And It's just too irresistible a comparison for me.
Yeah.
And I wonder what thoughts you have about that.
Number one, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom kills. I really enjoyed this. One of the reasons on the technical side that you may be alluding to, the musicians in their technical execution are on the money. Again, here, someone has thought to go beyond the normal level of detail and say, look, we need to teach these people, you know, how to work their instruments. Brentford Marsalis, I was interviewed on a Questlove Supreme podcast, and he mentioned how he worked with all of the sidemen in that movie to make sure that, you know, their technical execution was on point. And it carried me right into the movie. You know, even a minute detail as saying, this is the 20s, Mr. Bozeman, so you can't stand in a crouch like Miles Davis. He hadn't been born yet. You got to put your horn straight out, you know, like Louis Armstrong or Joe Oliver was depicted playing. It really brought me into the film.
I felt like the kind of chops busting that those musicians did, you know, in the break room and as they're getting ready, like that all felt really true to the time and atmosphere. You know, a lot of that goes all the way back to August Wilson and the way that he wrote that dialogue. But I loved seeing the rapport that Bozeman had with the other actors, especially with Coleman Domingo, who plays the session leader and the trombonist and band leader. You know, everything about the tensions and the kind of grudging respect, it all just really rang true to me.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, this is one of those portrayals that again harks back to that ageless calculus, right? Between like, okay, am I going to pursue the muse and certain destruction, you know, or am I going to kind of stick to the rules and like, you know, do the job.
Right.
But, you know, Wilson is very self-conscious as he lays out those stakes. And, you know, and so I feel like you sort of accept the terms as you go along there.
You do. And quite frankly, you see, you know, a woman in charge. You know, you're thinking of the 1920s, not only the stereotypical images that may be in your mind or prejudices that you may have, but you see someone who says, you know what, I'm not going to shy back from getting what I want, you know, down to the minutiae of, you know, having her special Coca-Cola before she sings. You know, she doesn't need them. They need her. And she's not afraid to speak out and speak up about, you know, who's really running the show. That was actually refreshing to see, thinking about that time period.
Yeah. And the way that she is, you know, really acutely aware of what it means to hand over the rights to what she does, you know, understanding that, you know, once the voice is captured on a recording, it becomes an object.
That's right.
It becomes something to be commoditized. And, you know, ultimately, it's no longer in her control. And it's interesting to think about that as we skip ahead in the timeline and take a look at Dorothea Williams in Soul, another really sort of unapologetically in control band leader who clearly, I mean, you know, as we've said, we don't know her story, but clearly she has had to, you know, claw and fight her way into that position, you know, to earn that respect.
That's right.
And she's not going to take no BS from anybody, you know?
Right.
And it was interesting to me, the epiphany in Soul, right? After he plays what by all accounts is a really successful set or a couple of sets at this club, you know, so he's climbed the mountain and everybody in the band leaves the club, like backslapping and man, that was a good one. What a, you know, great night. See you tomorrow. And he's kind of like, wait a minute, is that all there is? You know? And her response, she's like, we come back, we do it again tomorrow, you know, and maybe it'll be as good, maybe not. But for someone like her, who's been around, a big part of inspiration is showing up to do the work.
That's it.
It's not about, you know, the celestial spirits aligning. It's about rolling up your sleeves and doing the work.
Mm-hmm. A process, not an event. And I think that's where Joe eventually arrives. But it ends just kind of a bit open-ended. We don't know if he goes back to teaching. We don't know if he's going to go back to the club the next night. And just for me, a bit more resolution there would have even perhaps put this movie in a different light. I don't know, but I would have rather had somewhat of a resolution at the end of that movie, personally.
Well, you know, Finding Nemo gave us Finding Dory. So maybe you're right, Greg. Maybe there is a Dorothea Williams story up ahead. I just hope they don't make it a biopic.
Yeah.
Nice. Let's figure something out.
Yeah.
We should note here that Soul, the original motion picture soundtrack, is available on streaming services and wherever you purchase your albums, and the tunes featuring John Batiste and friends are well worth hearing. We should also note that John Batiste has received 2 Grammy nominations. That's something I think we're going to be talking about a little later this month. He's up for Best Contemporary Instrumental Album for Chronology of a Dream, Live at the Half Note, The Village Vanguard, as well as Best New Age Album for Meditations, which he made with Corey Wong. And I don't think we can say much more than this, but Batiste has also got some exciting stuff coming up early in this new year. So watch this space.
Yes.
But as we're going out, why don't we hear one more bit of music from the Soul soundtrack? Sure. What do you think, Greg?
That sounds good. This is a song that made it into the movie from our canon, courtesy of Donald Byrd and Duke Pearson originally. This tune is called Cristo Redentor.
Of WBGO and is hosted by Greg, Brian, and Nate Chenin. It's produced by Sarah Kirsten. Simon Wendler is the senior producer.
You can hear Jazz United on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WBGO.org.